of the service instead of now as a response to the message. And I forgot to take up the offering earlier, so we'll do that then too for the at the end. Yeah, we'll do it. Psalm 103. Not working. There we go. Psalm 103. Bless the Lord, O my soul, and all that is within me. Bless his holy name. Bless the Lord, O my soul, and forget not all his benefits, who forgives all your iniquities, who heals all your diseases, who redeems your life from destruction, who crowns you with loving kindness and tender mercies, who satisfies your mouth with good things, so that your joy is renewed like the eagles. That's all we're going to have time for this morning. And my machine isn't working here for some reason. There we go. Bless the Lord. It's Thanksgiving weekend. And our culture has bought into the idea of having a Thanksgiving weekend. There's just a few oddities about it. One is that you hear a few statements that, when you think about it, just doesn't make a lot of sense. Happy Thanksgiving. Think about it. Thanksgiving, is, as we mentioned other times, is an act of recognizing a benefit from someone else as you're the recipient of the benefit. And so you are honoring them and you are humbling yourself to the person you're thanking, right? So it's about making yourself less and the other person greater. But then when you say happy Thanksgiving, what are you saying? Isn't that the opposite, that you're trying to build that person up? Anyway, it's just a little strange. But the other thing is, in our culture, you see the term give thanks. But there's no mention of who you give thanks to. There's lots we have to be thankful for. But thanks, I don't think I'm insulting your intelligence by reminding you that there's a donor or a giver of a benefit and there's a receiver, right? There has to be two parties. The person who thanks someone else. But there's really a very limited number of people involved. We give thanks to God. We don't get other people involved when we do that. Praise is a little different. When we receive a benefit from someone, if they give you $10 for nothing, then you say, hey, did you hear what he did to me? Like, you go around, you tell other people, right? That's what praise is all about. You're broadcasting to other people what someone has done for you. So that's the difference between praise and thanksgiving, is that one is directly to the donor, the other is telling other people what that donor did. I think you understand that. But what is worship then? How does that fit in? Well, worship is recognizing who God is for what he has, who he is, not so much for what he has done. So if we, this isn't working, so we're going to have to go without it. If we look at the attributes of God, his character, all the things that he is, that's worship. We're not worshiping God necessarily for what he has done, but for who he is. Now, with that in mind then, we had, we'll click it through to the list of songs. How many of those songs were worship? How many of them were praise? And how many of them were thanksgiving? Should be right after this. Right after this. There. There are the songs we sang this morning. First one, How Great Thou Art. Is that a song of worship, of praise, or thanksgiving? What would you say? It's worship because of who he is. He's great. However, there is a line in there that says, and when I think that God, his son not sparing, sent him to die. So in a sense, it's also praise, right? We're praising people for what he's done, but we're also worshiping him for who he is. Then, what's the next one? Blessed be your name. What is that? Worship or praise? That would be praise as well, right? And the next one is Jesus Messiah, name above all names. That's worship. And your name is a strong and mighty tower. That's worship. All hail the power of Jesus' name. That's worship. So we had some great worship songs this morning. And we can be glad that we have all these songs to sing. Now, unfortunately, worship has deteriorated somewhat in our culture today. I'm not going to go into all the details, but you see dance routines, for example, in the worship service. You see special lighting and smoke and all kinds of things while the praise team. These detract from worship. And we'll talk about that in a few minutes. William Dunlop made a statement, and he talked about the word bless. That should come up here now, too. The word bless. Blessed be the Lord. What does that mean? Now, if you live in the deep south, you'd hear you have all kinds of people blessing your heart, right? And we hear people who will say, well, the Lord bless me with, and you name the list, like a spouse, a family, a job, and so on. So the word bless is usually used in the term that someone like God has given us some benefit, right? And we're recipients of a material blessing. But we're told to bless the Lord. How do we do that? God is complete in himself. He has all that he needs. He doesn't need us. There's nothing that we can add to who God is and what he's done. How can we then, who are just finite individuals, bless an eternal God? Well, we turns out if we look up the word bless in a lexicon, and it says that that word that's used there can be translated in many different ways. It can be translated thank. It could be translated as praise or worship or adore. So it's a recognition of God, what God has done for us. It's a recognition of who God is. But it's not used in the same way that we would think of it in terms of us. And although we can't add anything to who God is, it's still appropriate to bless and thank and praise him. Here's William Dunlop's statement. To bless God is to embrace every proper opportunity of owning our veneration. To venerate means to honor a deity. Our veneration and esteem of his excellence, greatness, and to declare to all about it us so as loudly as we can the goodness and grace of his conduct towards men and our infinite obligation for all our enjoyment to him in whom we live, move, and have our being. In other words, it's a recognition of everything that we have and can do because of what God has done for us. That's what the word bless means. We can't add anything to God, but that's what we do. Now, my soul, who's David talking to here? We need to watch this because it's going to make a lot of sense when we get later on in the verses. Who's he talking to? His soul. He's talking to himself. It's like a soliloquy. And our blessing of God always starts within. It's not something that comes from outside. Jesus said in Matthew 22:37, You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and all your mind. He says it starts within, doesn't it? With the love of God. And we can't bless the Lord unless it starts there. Oh, my soul. It permeates our whole being and how we live, but that's where it starts. Next phrase in Psalm 103. All that is within me. What's within you? Your liver, your kidneys, and all. You know, he's not talking about that. He's talking about our soul, right? Our soul, who we are. So there's lots of parts of us. There's our conscience. We bless God with our conscience because of how we're faithful in to obey his standards. We bless God with our judgment by making decisions according to his will and his word. We bless God with our imagination by musing on things which are honoring to him. We bless God with our affections by loving what he loves. We bless God with our desires because of we seek only what he wants us to seek. We bless God by our memory, by remembering his blessings and his benefits to us. We bless God with our thoughts by meditating on his word. We bless God with our hopes by looking and longing for the glory that shall come. We bless God, with our senses by their integrity and their faithfulness and their loyalty to him. We bless God with our words by telling the truth. We bless God with our actions by being living in integrity. All these things. And you can probably add to the list. What he's saying is, in all of these areas, bless the Lord, all that is within me. Keep in mind, this does not just apply to the second weekend in October. You know, this is a lifestyle that we live continually, that we constantly seek what would be honoring to him and blessing the Lord. And then he goes on and he says, bless his holy name. Bless his holy name. We've been singing that this morning. So, first of all, this statement, bless his holy name. We've had the theory earlier, now this is the test. Is this worship, praise, or thanksgiving? So thanksgiving is for something he's done for us that we thank him. Praise is for something he's done for us and then we tell others about it. Worship is his character and his attributes. And so when we bless his name, that would be part of his attributes, right? So it would be worship, right? He starts out here in this psalm talking about worship. And he says we're going to worship him for his holy name. Now, what does holy mean? We think of it as someone who's perfect and pure and sinless. But it also means separated for a cause. God is holy. He is other than us. He is entirely independent of any of his creation. And we've lost a sense of that. When we think of Isaiah, when he met God, what did he do? He said, I'm undone. I've had it. That's the way we'd say it today. That's the end. When he saw God, when he worshiped God, a holy God. A man by the name of John wrote the book of Revelation. He met Jesus in his risen, resurrected, holy form. What happened? He fell down dead, just like he was dead, before a holy God. This was John, who spent years with him, talked with him, sat around the campfire with him. He was the beloved disciple. when they were at the table at the Last Supper, lying down, he was leaning against him. And now when he sees the Holy God, he fell down like he's dead. He says, bless his holy name. A magnificent God. A man by the name of A.W. Tozer, which many of you will know, says, worship is no longer worship when it reflects our culture around us more than the Christ within us. And many times people try to bring the worship into our culture, or the culture into our worship, rather than affect our culture by our worship. And we need to be very careful. But the question is, how can I worship God when I don't feel like it? How does that work? I don't feel like going to church this morning. I don't feel like singing. You know, do our feelings have anything to do with worship? Well, Jesus made a statement to the woman at the well. And he says, those who worship God must worship him in spirit and in truth. Is truth affected by your feelings? Why do we worship God? Because of who he is and his attributes and his being. His name, his power. We can go through the whole list. Does your feelings affect that truth? No. So the fact is, we should worship whether we feel like it or not, because worship is a declaration of who God is to our soul. And then it will have an effect. A man by the name of Eugene Peterson, some of you will know him from having given us the Message Bible. He says, feelings are great liars. If Christians worshiped only when they felt like it, there would be no precious little worship. We think that if we don't feel something, there can be no authenticity to it. But the wisdom of God says something different, that we can act ourselves into a new way of feeling much quicker than we can feel ourselves into a new way of acting. Does that make sense to you? I'll come back to that. Worship is an act that develops feelings for God, not a feeling for God that is expressed in an act of worship. And what he's saying then is, our worship doesn't come from our feelings. It comes from the fact of the truth about God. And when we go through the worship, then we will develop the feelings. The feelings come later. And in our sinful nature, we don't automatically have feelings for a superior being. That's the danger. And so worship is something that we do in spite of how we feel. The next phrase, and forget not all his benefits. We just looked at a phrase earlier. We're blessing him for his holy name. That was worship. Now it says, forget not all his benefits. Is that thanksgiving or praise or worship? Benefits. It could be praise or thanksgiving, couldn't it? It's something he has done for us. And then we declare it to other people, or we thank him in return. So he's saying, don't forget. That's a little more powerful than saying, remember. You walk out the door and your spouse says to you, don't forget to pick up those prescriptions. You're hearing it a little more clearly than if they said, remember to pick up the prescriptions. And so he's reminding us. One of the problems all the way through the Old Testament that God had with the Israelites in particular, or his people, is that they didn't remember. The whole book of Deuteronomy is written about remember, remember. Deuteronomy in chapter 32, verse 18, says, of the rock who begot you, you are unmindful and forgotten the God who fathered you. That was their problem. And later on in the book of Isaiah, David wouldn't have read this, but Isaiah wrote a similar thing. He says, the ox knows its owner, the donkey its master's crib, and Israel does not know my people and do not consider. How about us? Do we remember? Now, he says, don't forget all your benefits. But what's he talking about? What benefits? Now, this is Thanksgiving, and we often sit around the table with our families, and we say, now, what are you thankful for, right? You get the kids to list of things they're thankful for, and we talk about, oh, the pumpkin pie and the new bike I got and all this sort of thing. Are those the things that David's talking about here? How do we know he's talking about something different? Who is he talking to? His soul, all right? Your soul doesn't get pumpkin pie and it doesn't get a bicycle. The benefits he's talking about are benefits to our soul. And just in case we missed it, then he starts the list. And so the list is starting in the next verse. He says, who forgives all your iniquities. Forgives all your iniquities. Well, that's a great benefit to start off with, isn't it? David knew about forgiveness. David was just an ordinary person. But you know, if you talk about David, people will remember the things that he did wrong. Right? Isn't that crazy? And they'll remember that about us too. Do you remember the time he, and that sort of thing? But David was a serious sin. He committed adultery. He murdered. He concealed it. God found him out. And when he was found out, he confessed his sin, and he wrote a whole psalm about it. And he understood the forgiveness of God very clearly from what we read in Psalm 51. He says, have mercy upon me, O God, according to your loving kindness, according to the multitudes of your tender mercies, and blot out my transgressions. Wash me thoroughly from my iniquity and cleanse me from my sin. For I acknowledge my transgression. My sin is always before you, before me. Against you, and you only, have I sinned and done this evil in your sight, that you may be found just when you speak and blameless when you judge. Behold, I was brought forth in iniquity, and in my sin my mother conceived me. Behold, you desire truth in the inward parts, and in the hidden parts you will make me know wisdom. Purge me with hyssop, and I shall be clean. Wash me, and I shall be whiter than snow. Make me hear joy and gladness, that the bones you have broken may rejoice. Hide your face from my sin and blot out my iniquity. Create in me a clean heart. Over and over, he understood, obviously, that God forgives. And he forgave us. It's a tremendous benefit. And one that we can be tremendously glad of at this Thanksgiving season. But then he goes on. And he says, he heals all your diseases. Oh, I'm sure David had a few diseases in his time, and he may have felt that God healed him when he was sick, or someone else was sick in the family. Do you honestly think that God heals all your diseases? If he wants to. But here he's saying he heals all your diseases. And you hear people preach from this passage, and they say, look at there. It says that God will heal you of all your diseases. And if he's not healing you, it's because you don't have the faith, right? And they put it back on you. It's your fault. Can I ask you a question? Who's he writing to here? His soul. We need to remember the context. This is not writing to his body that gets cancer and diabetes and heart condition. He's talking to his soul. What sort of diseases does our soul have? Anger, envy, pride. What's the big word? Sin. All right? He's not talking about physical ailments here, but he is talking about our spiritual ailments in our soul. And now it's clear. David was a poet. And when David wrote poetry, he used tools for the poetry. And one of the tools that they used in poetry was to write parallel statements. So the first one says he heals all your diseases. The first one says he forgives all your iniquities. The second one says he heals all your diseases. It's saying the same thing twice. That's all he's doing. Emphasizing that God is a God who cleanses us and heals us from what really ails us, and that is sin. He's not concerned about this earthly world. He's talking to his soul. And we're going to have to remember that again in a few minutes, who he's talking to. What David didn't understand, I believe, and I don't know of this for sure, I don't think he understood the cost of that. It was easy for him to say, Lord, forgive me. That was awful. I shouldn't have done that. But he didn't know the cost of forgiveness. Forgiveness always costs. If you have someone who owes you money and you say, nah, forget it, you pay the cost. You lose. The person who forgives always loses. If someone has offended you and you say, never mind, I forgive you, you pay the cost. You don't see the result of a judgment or retribution from that person. And Jesus came in a human form to pay the cost. God paid the cost for our sin. David couldn't have known that. He couldn't have foreseen the cross, other than the fact that God inspired him to write Psalm 22 and so on. He may not have known what that was all about. But we know. We know that when God forgave our sin, he had to take that sin and the cost for that sin himself. There was no other way. We understand the logic of forgiveness. And so when Christ hung on the cross, he paid the penalty for David's sin way back then. Somebody had to pay the cost, and it was God. And the next phrase, who redeems your life from destruction. Really, in a sense, this is a third statement of the same thing. He's forgiving our iniquity, he's healing our diseases, and he's redeeming our life from destruction. This is a little step further. David understood not only that he had sinned, but he understood the destruction of sin. He understood what sin will do to your life. Now, he didn't have access to this passage, but in Ezekiel 18, verse 4, Ezekiel wrote something that he would have known. Behold, all souls are mine. This is God speaking. The soul of the Father, as well as the soul of the Son, is mine. The soul who sins shall die. David knew that. It started right in Genesis. God said, sin will make you die. And so he knew that in order to forgive sin, God then made it so that we have life. Now this word redeem is actually, we use just one word, but it has an idea behind it. And the idea is of a redeemer, a kinsman who purchases you and saves you from destruction. Jesus Christ came as our redeemer, kinsman. The illustration is seen in the book of Ruth. Those of you who know the book of Ruth know that Boaz purchased the property from Naomi, and in redeeming that property also purchased his bride, Ruth. Jesus came and paid the price for the sin in this world, and in so doing, he paid the price of the bride, the church. But he had to become our kinsman. He had to become a human being. And so that's the idea here, is that God would come as a kinsman and purchase us to save our life from destruction. Life from destruction. That's an interesting phrase. There's an old poem with an interesting title that's called Strife in Heaven. And I'm not going to read the poem. I'm going to give you the idea of what's in this poem. A man is walking the streets of heaven and he encounters a group of people who are in hot debate as to who was a recipient of the greater grace from God. And so each one tells their story of how God saved them and what their life was like and so on. And in the end, they voted. And as they voted, they eliminated until they were down to two. And these two were given the opportunity of recounting their story, and then the final vote was to be cast. The first person died at an old age, but he was a reprobate, an awful sinner, committed just about every sin imaginable, including murder. And on his deathbed, the light of the gospel shined into his heart, and he trusted Christ for salvation. Marvelous story. And he says, I have been recipient of the greatest grace of all, because how can God possibly save such a wretch as I am? A second man died in an old age, but he was saved when he was very young and stayed faithful to the Lord all through his years. And so, as he told his story, there wasn't much to tell, except that he died still in faith. And so the vote was cast. And it was a foregone conclusion of who was going to win. When they found out, it was the man who had been saved when he was very young. The man who was saved when he was older, at least the man who was saved when he was late in his life, was certainly a recipient of great grace. God had saved him from destruction. But he didn't save his life from destruction. The fellow who was saved when he was young had the grace of God applied to his life at every stage in his life. Not just once. When the temptations of youth came along, when the challenges of marriage, the jobs, and old age, faithfully God gave him his grace to live for him.